any Bill Vaishnavi Bill Namo All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Is this working or not? It keeps flashing on and off. Okay. So can you all hear me now?
Yes, Pooja, we are able to hear you clearly. We can start.
Okay. I can never tell. All right. So I got a list of questions sent to me. I guess this is continuing on from the ones that we were talking about in our first session. By the way, does everybody speak English?
Yes, Praji.
Yes, all right,
Can
very
begin
good.
from question number three.
Okay. Oops. Right. Okay, question three. As a personal servant of Srila Prabhupada, how did you maintain your spiritual outlook of Srila Prabhupada as a transcendental acharya, despite very closely tending to his bodily ailments and needs? You can also tell us how we maintain our spiritual outlook towards all devotees in general while living in the community of devotees. That's a good question. How to see your spiritual master in all circumstances as a transcendental personality, and rather than seeing him as just, in a mundane way. For me, this was one thing that I was pretty conscious of, or I tried to be conscious of, right from the first day that I started doing Prabhupada's personal service. Because if you only do it once or twice, it's easy to keep a very humble attitude, and you can deal. Prabhupada gives an example that it's like the deities and fire. If you worship the deity, you can make tremendous spiritual advancement. But if you don't worship the deity properly and you become negligent, then that it's like a fire that gives light and heat. It'll keep you warm. But if you get too close to the fire, then you get burnt instead. So this was something that I was conscious of, I think practically throughout the whole time that I was with Srila Prabhupada. I found that the only way that you could maintain a proper outlook, it was just to cultivate humility. I'll give a couple of examples. When Prabhupada came to Delhi in November 75, that was when I was added onto his party. So first 3 or 4 days, I was just recruited to just do Prabhupada's massage. Then in Vrindavan on December the 2nd, 75, then Prabhupada added me as his full-time servant, and I remained doing that service until March of 1977. So about a year and a half, a little bit less than a year and a half. So one of the things that I was aware of even before becoming, a permanent, so-called permanent servant of Prabhupada, I knew that it was a potentially tremendous opportunity if I took advantage of it properly, and I knew that it could be the pathway to hell if I didn't. So there's a few anecdotes I'll tell to try to illustrate this. Well, let's see. When I joined Prabhupada's party, he was in Delhi, and he was giving darshan every evening. And at the end of the darshan, Prabhupada had been eating from a plate. He had a silver plate that that his servants carried around permanently with them. And during the darshan, somebody had come and offered Srila Prabhupada a basket of fruit. So that basket of fruit was sitting on the Prabhupada's desk. I came into the room. Prabhupada called me over and he pointed to his plate, which he'd just been eating from. He said, take this plate and wash it. And then he pointed to the basket of fruit that was under his desk. He said, take these fruits to the temple. They can be offered to the deity. Of course, those days, Delhi temple was very, very tiny. Prabhupada was staying in a small flat just down the road, actually. As soon as Prabhupada made this request, of course, I was very eager to serve him. So I immediately took Prabhupada's plate in one hand. And I was thinking as I was picking it up, wow, this is really special. I'm touching the plate that Prabhupada himself has personally eaten from. So I was thinking, you know, this is great. And then I reached out and I took the basket of fruit in the other hand. And Prabhupada immediately stopped me. He said, what is this you're doing? He said, I've just been eating from that plate, and now you're touching it, and then you're touching the fruit which it has to be offered to the deities. So he said, go and wash your hands and the plate, then go and take the fruit down to the temple. So that was the first instance I experienced of being chastised by Srila Prabhupada. Not quite the first, actually, but it reminded me how careful that we have to be if we want to maintain a close proximity to the guru. And my realization was that if I stay on Prabhupada's party, at some point or another, I'm bound to make mistakes. Nobody can avoid it. So that would be an offense. So what to do? I considered it and I thought, well, I've got two alternatives. One is that I do the service despite the risks of making offenses. Or I don't get so close to Prabhupada, I can appreciate him from a distance. That will protect my spiritual life and save me from making any, offenses to Prabhupada. So, of course, any devotee would want to worship Srila Prabhupada. And I wasn't going to give up that chance. that would have been, giving the most unique and beneficial service. And it would mean abandoning the chance to do that in order to, remain in an offenseless condition. So anyway, I thought that if I do the service, I'm bound to make mistakes and commit offenses. On the other hand, if I don't do the service, that's my track. If I don't do the service, then I'll be missing out on, an unbelievable opportunity. I mean, Prabhupada had about 5,000 disciples at that point, and I was just, one of many devotees in the temples. So I decided that, I would take the risk. I wanted to do this service, and that if I did make an offense, then the only way that you can rectify that is by being very humble. humility is, at least I always felt that humility is the basis of our devotional service. If you don't have a humble attitude, we're bound to make mistakes, and then you know we commit offenses and have to suffer for that. So the mood of humility is a protection against offense. If we deal with somebody and we don't deal rightly with them, you know, it's very easy to offend people. But the best way to counter that tendency towards being offensive is to just be very, very humble. Admit your mistake and try hard not to do it again. And Prabhupada would, you know, accept that. So I understood right from the very beginning that if I want to keep on regarding Srila Prabhupada as a transcendental acharya, as you've written here, then I have to maintain this mood of humility. Otherwise, it's very dangerous. And I'd heard from other devotees sometimes that former, not all, but some of the former servants or secretaries had committed offenses whilst they were doing the course of their personal service to Prabhupada, and had ended up actually leaving the movement. So that was a very real risk. So that was my general mood. I'll give another example. In Melbourne, Prabhupada was giving a lecture. I think this was like 74. This was before I became his personal servant. And in his lecture, Prabhupada was stressing the need for the devotees to execute their devotional service enthusiastically and very carefully, and be, you know, humble. We should always be humble in our dealings with others. So at the end of the lecture, then Prabhupada took a few questions. One devotee that was there had been living in the temple for some time, then he had moved out. And in general, if somebody, you know, was in and moved out, it was usually with, you know, some kind of, not enmity, but like a fault-finding mentality. I mean, having a fault-finding mentality is inherent in all conditioned souls. And so anyway, this particular boy, he was having trouble maintaining his spiritual practices. He'd moved out of the temple. He was with another small group that were becoming increasingly critical of ISKCON devotees in general, or, you know, our God brothers and God sisters. And so he asked Srila Prabhupada, well, he was stressing about humility, so how does one become humble? So Prabhupada, he answered that very simply. He said, that is up to you. So we have to be humble, but it's a choice. There's always in our, you know, when we're dealing with somebody, if it gets into a difficult situation, it can spiral out of control. The, you know, heaviness in the heart blocks your spiritual outlook. You know, we fall away. But if we're humble, even if we do something really bad, then Prabhupada, he would always forgive that. So, I mean, there's quite a few examples in my own experience about making sure that I kept the right mood towards Srila Prabhupada. So I lasted about 16 months. It wasn't easy keeping up with Srila Prabhupada on a daily basis, because Prabhupada's consciousness, of course, was on the highest level. My consciousness was generally on the lowest level. And so you had to be very careful. And I got to a point in early 1977 when I started to think that it was time for me to change my engagement. There was a number of reasons for that, but one of them was that I had felt myself and my general outlook in serving Prabhupada. I felt that slipping a little bit. For instance, one day Prabhupada went to the bathroom. When he came out from the bathroom, there was no towel. So he had to call me from my room, and he asked me, "Where's my towel?" And I had given that duty of keeping all of Prabhupada's clean linens and blankets and sheets and towels, etc. I delegated that to one boy called Akshaya Das, who was also traveling with us as Prabhupada's door guard. So he had taken the items that I gave him. When Prabhupada came out saying there's no towel there, he remembered that he realized he had forgotten to put the towel in Prabhupada's bathroom. So that way Prabhupada told me, he said, these are small things, he said, but if they're not done, then it gives me some inconvenience. So that's like committing offenses from neglect or forgetfulness. And there were a couple of other incidents of a similar nature. While in themselves, they were not, you know, huge offenses, but they do lead to, you know, one small thing leads to another, and you start to accumulate. So I felt if I keep on making these kinds of mistakes, I'm going to commit offenses, and then that will be very bad for my spiritual life. So I decided that I needed a break. And one afternoon here in Mayapur, I went on Prabhupada's roof, where he was staying in the daytime on the rooms there that Jayaprataka Maharaj is using now. And this was after lunch. I asked Srila Prabhupada, I didn't ask him, but I expressed to him that I felt that I needed some kind of a break. I said, I don't want to commit offenses. And as soon as I said that sentence, Prabhupada brightened. He said, yes, very good. So he was happy that I was aware enough of my own condition and my own state of consciousness that there was a chance that I would commit offenses. Prabhupada himself would not perhaps say anything, but that doesn't mean that the offense is not being committed. So he was happy that I was aware enough of my own possible diminishment of attitude, and he encouraged me. So then shortly after that, he sent me to Australia and made me the GBC there. But the point is that being humble enables us to examine ourselves. And if we don't have that humility, we don't make that, as Prabhupada said, that is up to you. You have to decide. If you don't make that decision, then there's every likelihood of committing offenses to devotees, committing offenses to the spiritual master also. So looking after Prabhupada, being his servant, was not an easy thing. I think myself and Shrudakirti were the longest serving servants. Shrudakirti Prabhu He did a total of 2 years on Prabhupada's party, one of 16 months, and then another 4 months, and another 4 months. I was on the party for 16 months, and then another month in 1977 as Prabhupada's visiting GBC secretary. So we have to be alert, not careless. And there are opportunities, of course, as you say here, we have to very closely tend to Prabhupada's bodily ailments and needs. I think myself that another one of the reasons why I left Prabhupada's party just, you know, at a time when Prabhupada was getting to the point where he couldn't travel anymore, my assessment of my own position at that time was that I've lost track of what I was saying there. Sorry, this is something that happens sometimes. Prabhupada required very intimate care, and you know, you have to be very conscious at all times of what Prabhupada was going through, or things that he required, etc. And I was a certain level that, you know, regular service the servants did. But when Prabhupada got really, really sick and bedridden, then I knew this is a kind of service which was beyond my, you know, personal capability. So Upendra was very good at that kind of, you know, needs of Prabhupada's, as his body began to break down, you know, his organs started to fail, with his kidneys, with his diabetes, heart palpitations, etc., etc. I kind of realized that that intimacy of service was actually beyond me. It needed somebody who was more mature, and somebody that was very more trained in that service. So, yeah, Prabhupada's bodily ailments, they had to be looked at very nicely. And actually, when I left the party in March of 1977, three or four different devotees came onto it. One of them was Bhatti Charu Maharaj. You've probably heard over the last couple of weeks in the glorifications of Bhatti Charu Maharaj, how he was able to serve Prabhupada in the most intimate fashion when he'd only been in the movement practically for a few months. So he's a good example of someone who, because of his gentle demeanor, he was a person who was just naturally in the mode of goodness. He was very intelligent, because of his qualifications, then Krishna and Prabhupada allowed him to come onto Prabhupada's party look after all the intimate needs that Prabhupada had or required. So Upendra also. Upendra joined ISKCON in 1967. So he was one of the first devotees. And it wasn't long after that he began doing some personal service for Prabhupada. Then Prabhupada sent him out preaching to various places in the world. He was the first devotee, along with Bali Mardand, to go to Australia and begin the preaching there. When I joined the Sydney Temple at the beginning of 72, Upendra was there at still living in Australia at the temple there, although by that time he had a wife and child. So in 77, when Prabhupada started physically to break down, his body was not functioning properly, then Upendra was called to look after him. So he and Dati Churu Maharaj, they were like Prabhupada's main carers. Abhiram Prabhu was there, and of course Tamal Krishna Maharaj was there as Prabhupada's secretary, etc. So I did some one final month as Prabhupada's personal secretary, when he had sent me back to Australia in March of 77. Then immediately after that, he made me the GBC there. So I had booked in for a one-month visit with Srila Prabhupada for later in the year. Prabhupada had a system whereby he wanted a permanent secretary, and he also wanted that one by one, any GBC or sannyasi, they could sign up for being Prabhupada's visiting secretary. You get 1 month to travel with Prabhupada. You could associate with him and, you know, do some personal service. So that was my way of training all the GBCs and leaders how to manage the society. Prabhupada was giving it all of us that individual opportunity. So in mid-77, when Prabhupada came back from Rishikesh, all of a sudden he thought that he was going to leave his body at that point. Somehow or another, that immediate crisis passed, and at the end of the month of May, then I approached Tamal Krishna Goswami and told him that I'd like to do a month as Prabhupada's visiting secretary. So he had signed me up for the month of October. So I went back to Australia, and later on, of course, Prabhupada went to London and celebrated Vyasa Puja, his Vyasa Puja there. And then they brought him back again to Bombay. So he was there for about 3 weeks, I think, in September. And then I arrived back in Bombay to be with him at the end of September, I think September 28th. And in the evening, Prabhupada then called all the senior devotees into his room, and he asked each of us what he should do. Should he stay in Bombay? Because although he had those nice quarters there, they were fixed up all right. There was a lot of noise, constant chipping and banging coming from the temple construction. So Prabhupada, it was a debate whether he should stay in Bombay until the opening of the Bombay temple, which was not fully fixed up at that point, but they had some idea maybe mid-October, November, then we could have the official opening. So that was one possibility. The other consideration was, should he go back immediately to Vrindavan, even though the Bombay temple was not opened. So Prabhupada asked each of us individually what he should do. Should he stay in Bombay or should he go back to Vrindavan? So one by one, I think there was about 8 or 9 of us in the room. Tamal Krishna Maharaj, Brahmananda, Abhiram, Kuladri, various servants. So, Gopal Krishna Maharaj, Giriraj Maharaj. So there was a good group of us there. So one by one we had to say. So when it came to my turn, I'd just arrived in the morning. I was pretty jet-lagged. So I wasn't quite fully tuned into the mood of the party there. So then I, rather than reply immediately, I asked whether it was for preaching or was it for health. So Prabhupada said it's for health. So then that was good enough for me. I voted that he should go to Vrindavan, and all of us did, except I think Gopal Krishna Maharaj, because he was the local GBC, and he knew that if Prabhupada leaves Bombay and goes back to Vrindavan, all the devotees are just going to stop what they're doing and their services and go and join him in Vrindavan, just in case, you know, the worst happened. So I did do 1 month. I arrived on September 28th. That decision to go back to Vrindavan was made the same evening or late afternoon. I was dispatched by Tamal Krishna Maharaj to fly to Delhi, which I did on the last plane out, and then collect together all the things that were extra things that we bought that Prabhupada would need if he was going to have a prolonged stay in Vrindavan. So one of the main things we decided was that the bedroom of Srila Prabhupada's quarters was much too small. So we set up Prabhupada's main living room and darshan room, and we put a double bed in the room. So that double bed, you can see, is still there. It cost 650 rupees, I think, at the time. When I arrived in Delhi, I stayed overnight, and then with a devotee called Bhagavata Shraya Prabhu, who was the temple president in Delhi at that time, we went to see a fellow. His name was Davan, and he had a wood furniture store, hand carved. So we went to see him. We told him we need a bed for Srila Prabhupada, a double sized bed. And he had one bed there, which, as I say, he only charged us 650 rupees for. And we immediately sent that with a double size mattress and pillows, pillowcases, etc., etc. And then in the afternoon, or late in the morning, I rang up Tamal Krishna Maharaj. I told him, now everything's ready. We've got what we need. So Prabhupada can come to Delhi. We were thinking that he would fly to Delhi and then go by road from Delhi to Vrindavan. But it was the end of the rainy season, and some parts of the road had been washed away. So instead of flying and then driving, Prabhupada instead took the train October the 2nd, I think. He with about 40 devotees came by trains directly to Mathura. And then we took Prabhupada to his rooms there, and of course that was where he stayed up.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare, Hare Krishna Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Hare, Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama. Rama, Rama, Hare, Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, Krishna Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.
Okay, can you hear me? Power's back on.
Yes, Praji, we are ready, Praji. You can start, Praji.
Okay.
Can you start the video?
Yeah. My video is on. I'm just going back to the questions. Okay. So, anyway, to get back to the original question. It's really a question of how conscious we are of ourselves and how we, deal with others. If we want to make spiritual advancement, as Prabhupada said, you have to be humble. And when he was asked how do you become humble, then his reply was, that is up to you. So we're a society of self-realization. It was, a question of being alert as much as possible, especially when you were with Srila Prabhupada. It wasn't easy to maintain that the kind of consciousness that was required to keep you up on a level of service to Prabhupada, that would not cause him any difficulty through our own neglect. Before we move on to the next question, does anybody have any questions about what we've been speaking just now? Can you hear me?
Yes, Praji. Praji, we can continue.
Okay. All right. So I hope that's gone part of the way. answering question three. Question four. What did Prabhupada mean by 50% work is remaining as Varnashram? It's a kind of interesting topic. It's been, you know, tossed around for years and years about Varnashram. Did Prabhupada really want it or not? It did come up when I was traveling with him. A couple of years before I joined the party, I think in about early 74, that was when Prabhupada had started telling the devotees to purchase land and make these self-sufficient farming communities. There's a few conversations that were recorded in that respect, and maybe even there was some newsletters that were sent out as well. So there was a number of farming communities being developed, and especially at that time, of course, New Vrindavan was there from the beginning, but Geeta Nagari Farm, that was the next one. In Australia, we got a farm there. Prabhupada started accepting land here in India. If you look in his conversations, I think on February the 14th, 1977, Prabhupada was in Mayapur, and we had a long talk about the need for establishing Varnashram in our society. So I'm not going to read it. You can read that conversation. It's very interesting. But the essence of it is that Prabhupada felt that unless Varnashram was in some form or other introduced in our society, then it would be difficult to make any real progress. Not that, and we put all the arguments that we could think of that had originally been given to us by Prabhupada anyway. We, you know, reminded Prabhupada that he would always said that Varnashram is not really necessary. All we need to do is chant Hare Krishna mantra and that will take care of everything. And Prabhupada's reply to that was, but who is chanting? He said, they're coming, people are coming, but they can't even chant the 16 rounds. Therefore, having a Varnashram system is not just to show the public how to live a civilized human life, but also for our own devotees, that they should live in an atmosphere of goodness. So Prabhupada felt that he got all the basic items in place. In fact, in December of 1976, we had gone to Hyderabad. There was a man there, his name was Hari Prasad Vadruka. He just recently left his body about a week ago. So he had gotten a parcel of land, about 560 acres. It was a big amount of land. He wanted to donate that to a trust. And that trust, I think it was called the Krishi Gauraksha something trust. That trust would have a majority of ISKCON practicing devotees as well as several members of Hari Prasad Vadruka's family. So Prabhupada, we had spent September, October and November of 76 in Vrindavan. Then on, I think, the 2nd of December, 76, Prabhupada was to fly down to Hyderabad and then spend 2 weeks on the farm there. So we packed up the night before. Jagadish Prabhu was Prabhupada's secretary. We were all in the car. I brought Prabhupada to the car at the No, there's a gateway just opposite Prabhupada's rooms at the Vrindavan temple. So Prabhupada came through there. As he climbed into the car, he said, now we're going to start a new phase of this movement. Then he didn't say anything. So Jagadish asked Prabhupada, what is that, Srila Prabhupada? And Prabhupada looked at him and said, Vanashram. So that was December of 76. And then, as I say, 77, in February here in Mayapur, Prabhupada again more strongly emphasized the need for Vanashram. Vanashram in itself, there's thousands of pages about this, I'm not going to try and repeat it. But Prabhupada felt that without the Vanashram system, it would be very, very difficult to get people into the kind of consciousness that was required to make spiritual advancement. In other words, you know, Sattva Gun, Udvam Gach Chanti Sattva Star. If you are situated in the mode of goodness, then you go up, or them, you know, attain a higher stage of life, whether this one or the next one. Majjhachis Tanchi Rajasa, if you remain on the platform of Rajagun, then you don't rise, you don't fall. You're just very busy doing nothing. And then, of course, the third, last one is Tamagun. If you're in Tamagun, then everything is abominable. You're completely in ignorance, and you'll not make any progress at all. Rather, you'll go the other way. So the Vanashram system is primarily a way of engaging people according to their karma and karma, according to work propensity and according to desires, then people should be engaged in what they're naturally inclined to do. And the whole Vanashram system centers on living in harmony with nature and with the other living beings that are on the planet. So if you execute the duties of Vanashram, it means that the general ambience, the atmosphere that you're in, it has to be in the mode of goodness. When it is, then that automatically opens the mind, it opens the intellect. You get deeper understandings of what you are, why you're here, where are you going, etc., etc. It's not very complicated in one sense. So when we went to Hyderabad, to the farm there, the first few days that we were there, Prabhupada was taking morning walks around the property, you know, seeing the different vicinities that were there. And he noted that there were some nearby villages. They're living on their own land. So Prabhupada started up an evening program whilst he was there, where at about 6:30, the devotees would go out around the villages, and they would invite people, mainly farmers, to come and visit our trust land. And Prabhupada's program was very simple, that he would attract people by doing kirtan. Then, after the kirtan, there'd be like a 5 or 10 minutes talk. And then after that, there would be some prasadam served out. Then as people became more advanced from contact with the devotees, then he said we would invite them to become devotees themselves. And the land that we had, that could be made available to each family, one house or two houses, they would grow their own food. housing itself would be like a small, what we call in English, hamlet. It means a small group of families living in together, say about one dozen. And each little group or village would have a main deity of Vishnu, Radha Krishna, Lakshmi Narayan, Balaji, whatever form of Krishna they were attracted to. But that would be the idea, that they'd rise up early in the morning, they'd attend Mangal Arati, then they'd go about their business in the day. Prabhupada said we should grow our own food, we should make our own clothes, we should build our own houses, we should grow our own medicine. So he said, with that, then you can remain self-sufficient. And that's it. That was the whole program. He just wanted these clusters, like small villages, here and there on the land. People would come, they would do some worship, they would toil in the day, growing what they needed for various aspects of their homes and food, cloth, etc. And then in the evening, they'd stop that work and come back to the temple, chant a little bit, and then go to bed. So that was Prabhupada's idea of a Varnashram system, nothing too complex. We started that program whilst Prabhupada was there, but unfortunately the local managers just couldn't get it up and running properly. I don't know why it is, but so far in ISKCON we have not managed to successfully introduce the Varnashram system. In Hungary, I heard that they're about 80% self-sufficient. I don't know about the Eco Village. Devotees must know a lot more what's going on there than I do. But this was Prabhupada's basic program. So in the middle of 77, Abhiram says that he was talking with Prabhupada. I think they were in Vrindavan. Some mention of Varnashram was there. And Prabhupada told the devotees, he said that I've only done 50% of my work. The other 50% is remaining. That's Varnashram. So when I came to Vrindavan in October for that last month, I also heard Ramananda tell Prabhupada that we need you to stay with us because so many things still have to be done. Only 50% of your work is still done. So when Brahmananda said that, when there's about 8 or 9 of us in the room, I thought that Prabhupada had kind of not completely agreed with that figure of 50%. But it's kind of commonly held that Prabhupada did say that. So we've got, you know, a long way to go. It's hard to implement Varnashram in this day and age, Kali Yuga, mechanical situation where the whole earth is being shattered by unqualified, greedy, selfish, envious living entities. Varnashram means living in harmony with the cycles of nature. Here in India, of course, you count 6 different periods. In the West, they only have 4 seasons: summer, autumn, winter, and spring. The idea is nature works in cycles, and through those cycles, you get all the items that are required for living and eating, etc., without too much endeavor. All you have to do is to agree to worship the Supreme Lord, do the yajna, By doing that jagya, the result will be that all the necessities of life become manifest within that Varnashram system. So without the Varnashram system, it's not possible to have the atmosphere of goodness. You know, people are, rather than working in harmony with nature, they see themselves as being in conflict with nature. And that's the problem. They're trying to conquer over. So we're familiar with this one small planet. So they're trying to conquer over it and become the masters of all they survey. So they're pushing Krishna out of the picture. So that kind of mentality, that acquisition mentality, leads to only conflict and unhappiness and debilitation, both of the situation that we're in and within our own hearts. So Prabhupada knew that if we're going to make a situation where a person takes birth as a human being and then has the chance to go back home, back to Godhead, that's the purpose of life. So if people are given the opportunity by good management of resources, by living in harmony with nature, then that mode of goodness becomes prevalent. And being in the mode of goodness, that means enlightenment can come. The heart becomes open. Krishna's within our hearts. He gradually reveals to us more and more if he's pleased with us for doing the jagya that is prescribed. So Prabhupada wanted us to at least have some section of society that was running on Varnashram principles. So we have a lot of work to do as far as that goes. Any questions on that one?
Purji, there is a connected question to the same question. Some say Prabhupada's emphasis evolved from Harinam to temple establishment to book distribution to Varnashram. How do we understand this evolving emphasis of an acharya?
The evolving nature of Varnashram.
The evolving emphasis, like he is like evolving from Harinam to temple establishment to book distribution to Varnashram.
So this emphasis. So Bhagavat Vidhi and Pancharatriki Vidhi, the two processes. To become a human being, you have to ultimately be initiated into the systems of Vaishnavism. And Prabhupada, what he hoped for was that he could create at least some examples of how to live in the mode of goodness. If you could do that, so with our farming communities, he thought, actually I was in Bhubaneswar, Rameshwara was visiting secretary at that time. Prabhupada was in Bhubaneswar for the opening of the temple there. He told us, he said that, first of all, just a few people will come. He was talking about, you know, having farming communities. He said, first, just a few people will come. Then hundreds will come. Then thousands. Then he said hundreds of thousands. So we can't imagine what that's like at the moment, just like if I gave you a small seed. We can't understand that the potency that's in that seed is sufficient that a huge banyan tree, you know, which can cover the whole earth practically, can be grown from such a tiny thing. But it is. That's how Krishna has, you know, devised and worked his material energies. So we may, you know, feel that this is a bit distant from what we're doing, since mainly Prabhupada established ISKCON as a preaching organization, and preaching organization is a little different approach, if you like, to becoming Krishna conscious than Varnashram. Prabhupada did say sometimes that Varnashram means you let the women and the children and those who are inclined for farming, they can go out and live on the land. But in the cities, we should have preaching facilities where people can come, they can study, they can go out and distribute Krishna consciousness for the benefit of others. So that distribution of Krishna consciousness is very, very important. And Prabhupada, you know, he knew that if we don't have access to the knowledge that's there, then we won't be able to make any real progress. So the knowledge means Bhagavad Gita as it is, Bhagavat Purana, and so many other books. So Prabhupada regarded book distribution as being the most important of all the services that he had given us. And that must go on, even if everything else shuts down. The book distribution, the knowledge has to be preserved and passed on for future generations. At some point, somebody will take it up again. Just like with the six Goswamis. They wrote so many books. But writing a book in those days means you get one stack of palm leaves and you handwrite. If I forget the name of the exact process, it's scratching actually. But anyway, they wrote these books. Somehow or another, for hundreds of years, the knowledge that's been in those books has been kind of hidden or sequestered. Now then, when Bhaktivinoda Thakur had his appearance, then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, now Srila Prabhupada, you can see gradually that knowledge that was kept hidden and condensed, if you like, that is now flourishing. It's coming out more and more, and it's picking up momentum, especially here in India now, I see. So we have to ensure that that acquisition and distribution of transcendental knowledge is always maintained. Does that answer your question?
Yes, Praji.
Okay. One last question.
Praji, one question I had related to the previous question you answered about respecting Srila Prabhupada as the spiritual master. The subsequent question that had been asked was on how devotees respected each other properly. So after Srila Prabhupada physically left us, gradually the need to depend on each other as Vaishnavas became more clear. So can you shed some light on that how post the spiritual master's presence, the need for each other and how we actually start respecting each other's opinion to become actually a proper Vaishnava. Can you share some things on that, please?
Well, I mean, it's simple in one way. Prabhupada created an international society and he based that on various aspects of sadhana that he thought would be practical for us to execute and not become a burden. If you're doing something and you think it, you know, this is just a burden, I'm fed up with it, then you'll give it up. But if you do something which increasingly enlivens you, then obviously the momentum expands. So therefore Prabhupada said, I'm building so many temples around the world because I remember, let's see, here in Mayapur in 1976, I think it was, Prabhupada was saying that we could chant Hare Krishna under a tree. The Goswamis were doing that. But if all we have when people come to Mayapur is a big tree, and no facilities, then nobody will come. So we have to create the facilities which will attract people to come. And from that attraction, then they develop relationships with the devotees. And then gradually they become devotees themselves. Ado Shraddha, Tathasada Sanghu. The first principle is that there's a little faith has to be established. If a person's faith is lost, it's very, very difficult to regain it again. So the first thing is to develop a bit of faith. The way you do that is sadhu sangha, by associating with like-minded persons, with other devotees. And then as you get more and more drawn into that, then you experience within that what Krishna tells Arjuna, in this Raja Vidya Raja Guhyam, the essence of all human knowledge, that's in the Bhagavad Gita. So we want to give people a chance to be able to read that, understand it properly, and enact the advice that's been given there. So we can't do that on our own. We need to help each other. Nobody can, or it'll be very difficult for somebody to execute their Krishna consciousness on a continuous basis without the association of other devotees. So in the early stages, of course, when we're coming from the material world and coming into Krishna consciousness, spiritual consciousness, it'll be a little difficult. The tendency of the conditioned soul is to fight and argue. And the generally, Prabhupada says, like a canisters are generally envious of each other. So we have to go beyond on that. Kanistha Adhikari stage means I go to the temple once a week, twice a week, whenever. I see the deity. I offer my respects. I go out from the temple and immediately Krishna is forgotten. So that's not good. What we want is that when people come to the temples, then they experience something which enlivens them and gives them more impetus towards, learning and association of what it means to be a spirit soul, what it means to be a servant of Krishna. These are our purposes. So Prabhupada wanted to provide us with the means for doing that. And if we take advantage of it, that's pleasing to Prabhupada, pleasing to Krishna. We make more rapid advancement. We can get off of that platform of the neophyte platform, criticizing others. That's one of the symptoms of becoming a more advanced Majjhima platform, if you like, where you worship God, you you make friends with the devotees, you give the knowledge to the innocent people, and the demons, demonic personalities, you give them a wide berth, just avoid them. And you don't criticize. It's one of the symptoms of an advanced devotee, is that he no longer criticizes any other devotees, because he sees them now as parts and parcels of Krishna to be served, rather than seeing everybody as an enemy or a competitor. So that early stage of Krishna consciousness, we have to get through that somehow or another. They're still devotees, but third class. Yeah. If we can get at least to the second class platform, and that's what our temples, at least in the cities, are designed to do, to bring people up off that platform, neophyte platform of criticizing others, and dedicate ourselves, our outlook and actions and activities towards the benefit of other living beings. Yeah. Whenever we're doing Krishna consciousness, it's for others' benefit. So, finally, of course, if one practices nicely, then you can be fixed up on the first class platform, and from that platform, then other people can be, you know, inducted into the practices and diksha. One gets the qualification, you know, to do many things in Krishna consciousness that you can't do as an ordinary neophyte. Does that answer your question?
Thank you, Bhagavan. Thank you. Would you like to take one more question, please?
Yeah. What are we on, number 5?
Yes, please.
How was Srila Prabhupada chanting schedule? Some say he would chant 64 rounds daily. When he would get time for that? When Prabhupada first went to America and he had started attracting these young people, Ramananda and Kirtananda, Hayagriva, so then Prabhupada began immediately to initiate people once they showed some determination. They'd understood from him what the purpose of life was, at least in a simple way. And so actually Prabhupada did his first initiations in September of 1966. So it's just like a few weeks after beginning the storefront in New York. Then he began initiating people. Some people had just walked in the door practically, and Prabhupada sat them down, and he did this, you know, fire jugya, and then he gave out, or he had the devotees go out and make these strings of beads. So Prabhupada told them, now you're initiated, you should chant on these beads 64 rounds daily. So after a day or two, they came back to Prabhupada, and they told him and said that, well, we've been trying, but actually it's not possible for us to chant 64 rounds. We just can't do it. So then Prabhupada said, all right, then 32 rounds. So then again, after a couple of days, they came and told Prabhupada that actually 32 rounds is just too much. We can't do it. So then Prabhupada said, all right, 16 rounds, but not less than that. And he stuck on that 16 rounds for the rest of the time. So that became the basis of our sadhana. Now, Prabhupada, from what I saw, he was chanting. So this is like 10 years later, 76, 77. Prabhupada was himself chanting 16 rounds every day. Sometimes more, depending on the circumstances, but he would always do it at least a minimum of 16 rounds. There was some professors who came to see him in Toronto, and one of them asked Srila Prabhupada, when did he get the time to be able to do so much prolific writing? The Chaitanya Charitamrita had just come out, 17 volumes. And the Bhagavatam was coming out, one or two volumes, you know, every month. And so this professor was just kind of bewildered how a single person could do so much work and run, you know, an international society all around the world. So Prabhupada explained his schedule. He said, I go to bed at 10:30. I get up at 12:00. I finish my rounds, if there is any balance. And then I do my writing 3 or 4 hours. He said at least something has to be there. Little drops of water wear away a stone. So he didn't specifically say that I, you know, chant 16 rounds. But when he said that I would, you know, complete my rounds and then sit down and do my writing, as a clear indication that he said, when I do the balance of my rounds. So that's a clear indication that he had a fixed number that he was doing himself. And Prabhupada never asked us to do something that he wouldn't do himself. So his schedule for chanting, it would depend on where we are, whether we were traveling or not. But always a minimum of 16. I can think of one or two incidences where Prabhupada excused a devotee for not doing all their rounds, especially one or two examples. Shamashunda Prabhu, because he was one of the first in that household, the crew, to go to London. So as they got connected with George Harrison, they were setting up a nice temple and everything. So he was working like anything, all day and night practically. So after a while, some of the devotees, they noted that he never chants his rounds. So somebody mentioned this to Srila Prabhupada, and it might have been his wife, Malati, I don't know. You'd have to ask her. But somebody went to Prabhupada and said, but Shamasunda's not chanting his rounds. Prabhupada said, that's all right. He's working full time for Krishna. So he said, Arjuna, he also was not chanting because he was fighting on the battlefield. So he excused Shamasunda for not doing all of his rounds. Well, that was in situations, where it was, there was a lot of pressure on the individuals to get things done. Like, say, when Prabhupada first came to India, he landed in Bombay, and then they got all these invitations. They went to Surat and Gorakhpur and so many other places. Hansa Dutta told me, he said, when we first arrived, we were so busy. Prabhupada was sometimes doing 4 or 5 programs every day. And so one time he went to see Prabhupada and he said, Prabhupada was doing, so many pandals and preaching and life membership was starting and so many other things. I can't get all my rounds done. I'm not chanting all my rounds. So Prabhupada said, that's all right. This is an emergency. You can go out and preach. So sometimes, very rarely, Prabhupada would make some special provision. I found one letter where somebody had written to Prabhupada. I don't have that letter that was written to him, but there is Prabhupada's reply, where this person was basically complaining that I just can't chant, japa. And Prabhupada told them, well, if you can't do 16 rounds, you can do, say, 8. Or if you can't do 8, then, just stay in the same room where other people are chanting and just listen to their chanting. Then you'll get more inclination to chant yourself. So Prabhupada was a little flexible sometimes. But other times you'll see he spoke very strongly, the bare minimum has to be maintained. Otherwise, things will not grow. So as far as his chanting 64 rounds, there are some anecdotes, I think, from some of his godbrothers. What was his name? Nayana. There was one of Prabhupada's godbrothers. I would just forget his name. Nayana something or other. He says that when Prabhupada was a householder, he would do his business in Calcutta. And then on the weekends, when he got the chance, he would come to Mayapur. And when he came to Mayapur, then he would simply chant. He said, and I remember he was chanting 64 rounds a day. When he was coming to the temple, he was also chanting 64 rounds a day. You know, when he was at home and doing his business to maintain his grihastha life. So that's a little, you know, that's a recollection of the memory from one of Prabhupada's godbrothers. It may not be very accurate because Prabhupada was not living in Calcutta or coming to Mayapur in the 1930s. He had gone to Allahabad, and that's where he was doing his service there. So, but still, the point is that this fellow had noted that Prabhupada was chanting 64 rounds a day. So Prabhupada himself had a great enthusiasm for chanting. And I'll finish with one small story. In the middle of 1977, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, and who was this? Bon Maharaj, Prabhupada's godbrother, and Akinshina Krishna Das Babaji. They came to see Prabhupada, and Akinshina Krishna Das Babaji was praising Prabhupada for what he'd done, you know, in preaching around the world. And Bon Maharaj, of course, was actually one of the, he was the first disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati to go to the West to try to do some preaching in the 1930s. But he was not able to get anything started very nicely. But he was maintaining some academic interest, let's say, and he knew one or two professors here and there. So anyway, they're with Prabhupada in Vrindavan. And Akinshina Krishna Das Babaji, he asked Bon Maharaj right to his face. He said, Swami Maharaj, he speaks fluent English. He also translates, you know, from Sanskrit into English. So, what's the other one? He could speak English. He could write in English. He said he went abroad. He went overseas, rather, and you know, created such a big society. He said, whereas you also, you're fluent in English, you're also a scholar, and you also went to the West, but you were a failure. He told him to his face. He said, you were a failure. So he said, why? So then he answered his own question. He said, because Swami Maharaj has great faith in the holy names. So that's another godbrother appreciating the Prabhupada's success. You know, the other things that he used, you know, his ability in English and Sanskrit, etc. But the main thing was that he had great faith in the holy names. And as a result of that, Krishna blessed him to do what he went on to do. So that's the main thing. Prabhupada was always chanting, whether it was 64 rounds, let's say like in the 1950s when he left home. It may be that he was chanting 64 rounds a day. As far as his time when ISKCON began, he was doing what his disciples were requested to do, which was chant at least 16. So, and he kept that standard, except at the very end, in 1977, you know, chanting a fixed number of rounds, that's a standard, that's sadhana. But it may come to a point where if one becomes very sick, as Prabhupada did physically, then it's not possible to chant so many rounds every day. So there were some times when Prabhupada didn't chant any rounds because, you know, from about July, August, September onwards, he was bedridden, and it just wasn't physically possible for him to do that. So there's room for adjustment, but there's general standards that we should try to follow as well. Is that all right?
Thank you so much, Prabhu. We will have more to hear from you tomorrow, Prabhuji.
Yes.
We are very grateful to you. You spoke so beautifully on how genuinely you developed a right attitude towards Srila Prabhupada as a personal servant. It was very instructive for all of us today, as you shared. Last time, as you shared on the health and the struggles that Prabhupada had to give us Krishna consciousness, that was heart-touching very, very deeply. Thank you so much, Prabhu. We look forward to more nectar from you tomorrow. Thank you so much.
Good. Thank you very much for inviting me. We'll speak again tomorrow. Thank you.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.